It's a celebration.
From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
It's a celebration.
Happy 4th of July weekend. Last month, part of the Good Food team went to Chicago to attend the James Beard Awards. If you listen to this show on the regular, I'm guessing you know what a big deal this event is for people in the food world. It was thrilling and inspiring to meet the people behind some of our favorite food content. We really love being part of the constantly expanding conversation around food and its cultural significance. Although Good Food didn't take home a medal, it was a huge honor to be nominated. So for today's show, we thought we'd share some interviews with people we've talked to who did win a James Beard Award this year. That's right. It's the All Winners, All the Time edition of Good Food. From her Ohio environs, Alexis Nicole Nelson has made a name for herself on Instagram and TikTok as the Black Forager. Tromping through forests and swamps, traversing hill and dale, she shares her discoveries, whether it's edible tree lilacs or maybe some pollen-laden cattails, often with a song.
This is the cattail.
And I know what you are thinking. Some nice dudes on here told me that they ain't good for eating. Well, gang, what if I told you that those nice dudes were wrong?
Hank, don't hate me.
What if I told you I'd eat cattails, but told you in a song? Meet the cattail. Rhizomes in the mud.
Hi, Alexis.
Hi, Evan. Oh, my gosh. Isn't listening to your own voice a trip?
I just have to tell you that your songs bring me such pure joy when I am just in the depths of despair.
Well, writing them has been like a really big source of joy during the, I'd call it tumultuous, last 9 or 10 months that everyone's been going through. So to hear that it makes other people smile, that's fantastic. It makes me so happy to hear.
When did you turn to TikTok and creating these songs?
So funny enough, I started my TikTok almost exactly a year ago to the day. My day job is in digital marketing focused on social media. So of course, with TikTok being the big new thing, my boss wanted me to know how it worked, and I would much rather fail under my own name than by the company's name. So around March of 2020, I posted my first, hey, I know you're nervous about going to the grocery store. I am too. Here's 5 plants in your neighborhood that you can harvest and eat different parts of. And I didn't think anything of it. I've foraged as a hobby for a really long time, and this was just kind of my first time committing it to any kind of video. And I woke up the next day and it had tens of thousands of views, which for me at that time was absolutely insane. So I figured, hey, I'll just keep taking people along for everything that I'm doing and all the kind of weird foods that I make and the songs that I sing, regardless of whether anyone's listening or not.
So let's go back a bit. Where did you grow up and where do you live now?
I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I currently live in Columbus, Ohio. So I have not strayed too far from home.
And how did you start looking for edibles in the great outdoors?
Well, if we want to go all the way back, my mom is extremely into gardening. That's kind of been her meditative practice. So I remember being very little, probably 4 or 5, and being outside with my mom, as I was often wont to do, and she pointed out a type of grass that looked a little different than the rest of the grass. And when you broke it, it smelled like onions. And she's like, well, this is onion grass. You can eat it if you want to. It comes up as a weed. And I don't know why that stuck with me all throughout the years. But as I got older, you know, I went to summer camps out in the middle of the woods, and a camp counselor would haphazardly tell us about an edible plant. And I would just commit it to memory. I'd, you know, go to the library and read up about it later. And it's just always been an interest of mine, this kind of intertwining between nature and the food we eat. And how that makes us kind of have a bigger respect. You know, I feel like when you can identify things in nature, you respect it a little bit more than you would otherwise. And now it's just grown into a full-blown obsession.
You're a vegan. Did the veganism intersect with foraging that was already happening? And has it sort of powered it in a way?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at it that way, it really does kind of seem like a logical step. I've technically been foraging in some sort of capacity since I was 5 or 6 years old. But now it's wonderful because it does add this kind of seasonal variety to my already very completely plant-based diet. It keeps things interesting. It makes me constantly challenge myself in the kitchen more so than I would have 5 years ago and more so than I would have 5 years before that. It's definitely challenging, but I love those kind of challenges.
How much of your daily eating includes what you forage?
Oh, I love this question. So it really varies during the year, but I would say in terms of volume, it's probably somewhere in between 10 and 20% during the winter. But when we get to, especially like late summer, early fall, when you have a lot of more calorie dense, plentiful foods coming into fruition, I could have an entire day where everything that I'm making, with the exception of maybe like an olive oil that's tossed into a batter or tossed onto some greens, is something that I foraged for myself.
This is a moment filled with Karens who want to police the whereabouts of people of color. How do you deal with that as you look for food in public parks and other public spaces?
Oh, golly. Well, the first step, honestly, is knowing the rules for where you are. I will say with a wink and a nudge, not necessarily saying that I do it myself, but I'm not saying that you're always following those rules, because some of them are antiquated and were put in place to do harm to Indigenous people and to people of color. But knowing the rules for where you are, when it comes to public parks and city parks especially, and so that's step one, because if you're in a space and say you have a permit to be gathering there, like I do for Wayne National Forest, someone comes up to you and is skeptical about what you're doing, and you know, you have a piece of paper to show them to be like, well, I can actually be doing this and maybe we can learn some stuff together. Do you want to know what it is that I am picking? Sometimes the answer is yes. Most of the time, the answer is no. And while I often want to get angry and be frustrated with people who are overly skeptical or even rude when they come up to me asking me what I'm doing, I really try to err on the side of giving them the benefit of the doubt and offering them education and a glimpse into what I'm doing, if at all possible. But if someone is seeming particularly persnickety, I also know when to call it and to just head home. It's a weird time to be a tall, loud, Black woman doing an activity that someone can't immediately identify.
You now have this enormous audience. Where are you with followers on TikTok? Almost at 500,000, right?
Oh my God, I know. I think I'm sitting around 450,000 right now.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. After we're allowed out of our bubbles, do you see yourself doing a lot of tours, taking people out?
Oh, absolutely. I have already been talking to folks at parks that are, you know, wanting and willing to host foraging walkabouts, because I love teaching people in person. I ended up becoming a camp counselor at that same overnight camp that I went to as a kid. And my favorite thing to teach was kind of like the wilderness skills, like these are the things you can eat in the woods, this is how you make a lean-to, like, you know, this is how to survive if for whatever reason you got stuck out here. There's something really cool about watching recognition of plants happening with people. And I honestly just believe that there is a degree of reverence for your surroundings that comes from getting to know your surroundings better. I love our environment. I would love for generations upon generations to continue to get to enjoy it in equally, if not more, pristine levels than it is in now. So anything that I can do that helps folks feel more connected to their surroundings, it just feels like a win for me.
I am so grateful that you came on the show today. Thank you so much, Alexis.
Thank you so much for having me, Evan. I'm sorry I had the most loquacious answers to all of your questions.
Oh, yeah, we love that. We love that.
That was forager and all-around sunny human, Alexis Nicole Nelson. You can follow her on TikTok and Instagram at Black Forager, or go to kcrw.com/goodfood for a link to her socials. Coming up, how Chinese restaurants played a crucial role in the history of food delivery.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Empire Sichuan in New York City wasn't the first restaurant in the U.S. to offer its food for delivery. But back in the 1970s, this wasn't a common thing. You can thank Chinese restaurants in Manhattan for popularizing the practice. It forced other kinds of restaurants and other cities to follow suit. As Chinese restaurants brought food delivery to a new level, Chinese cuisine found a home in a growing number of American kitchens. But every innovation was born out of struggle. As Ruth Tam and Patrick Fort of WAMU's award-winning Dish City podcast explain.
In November 1976, a woman named Misa Chang opened a restaurant called Empire Sichuan in New York City. It was a bleak month in New York. Cold, dark, not great if you're trying to get people to walk in for dinner. But Misa was inventive. After 2 weeks of really disappointing dine-in service, she printed out hundreds of paper menus advertising dishes like General Tso's chicken and mushu pork. Then Misa walked to nearby apartment buildings, snuck in, and slipped her menus under people's doors. And just 2 hours after she did this for the first time, she got her first delivery order. Wonton soup and an egg roll. Misa walked 2 blocks in the snow to deliver the food herself. And for her efforts, she got a $1 tip. Empire Sichuan was not the first restaurant to offer delivery. Some of the earliest ads for delivery were posted many decades earlier for restaurants in California, not New York City where Misa was. But if you look at what was happening in the 1970s, delivery, as Misa pioneered it, fit perfectly into the new on-demand consumer culture that was taking over at the time. You could see this in the way new products were being advertised on TV, like the ATM and the VCR.
We're missing the big football game.
Relax! My VHS home video recorder is taping it right now.
Terrific. Watch.
Terrific!
There was this increasing consumer demand for instant fulfillment. Instant gratification was a huge selling point, and Misa recognized this could happen with restaurant food. Chinese dishes at home almost whenever you want. Misa's strategy worked. So well, in fact, that she hired her first delivery boy, a 16-year-old high schooler who became her son-in-law, Eric Ma. And she made more hires as more orders came flooding in. She'd send Eric and her other delivery workers out with 8 orders at a time, and they'd bike hot food around the neighborhood for tips. I learned about Misa's story from a book called The Fortune Cookie Chronicles, and it was written by a woman named Jennifer 8 Lee. Jennifer says that in addition to taking food delivery to a whole new level, Misa was kind of responsible for this early form of spam marketing. Her flyers brought in so much business that they spawned a ton of copycats. And this turned into a flood of paper advertisements in New York apartment buildings. Jennifer says that the menus became such an overwhelming phenomenon that buildings would post signs that said, "No menus, please," outside their doors.
But at that time, it was really innovative and creative, right? It's like, well, people aren't coming into the restaurant to order my food. Maybe I will, like, deliver the food to them.
Was it kind of making the case, like, you can have our food in-house, like, in the restaurant, you can have it at home. Like, we're trying to meet the customer where they are.
Chinese restaurants' marketing was not super sophisticated, you know, with this, like, you know, messaging. And I think it just sort of naturally evolved as we will offer delivery. And then the more and more people kind of order delivery, the more and more some of these restaurants leaned into it.
Delivery put Misa's restaurant on the map. She got a review in the New York Times and eventually expanded her restaurant empire. There were Empire Sichuans as far as Miami.
And then you had not just Chinese restaurants doing it, right? In New York City, you had Japanese restaurants, or you had the Italian places. Like, you just, in order to be competitive in New York City, especially in Manhattan, you had to have some form of delivery.
It may have taken a while for this kind of restaurant delivery to take hold in other cities like San Francisco, Chicago, or Atlanta. But when it happened, Chinese restaurants were typically the first restaurants to do it.
So why were Chinese restaurants in particular the ones that spearheaded delivery in the U.S.?
Well, so I think back to our conversation with Emmalyn Rood. She's the food writer and historian that we spoke to in our last episode. She says the earliest Chinese restaurants were basically born out of struggle, and that every innovation that they pioneered, including delivery, is a part of that legacy.
Establishments such as Chinese restaurants that have been segregated into Chinatowns, that have faced discrimination up before 1922, a lot of the times, the way people talk about Chinese food, there'd be these horrible caricatures of Chinese people eating rats, and that was what people associated with Chinese cuisine. I think Chinese restaurants in particular had to find new ways to make an income, and food delivery is one of these innovations. All of a sudden, we don't only offer delicious food, good prices, we will be one of those places that will make it convenient, we'll bring it to your house. So I think it's a story of the need to innovate, where other eateries just didn't have to.
That's so wild to me, because Chinese food feels like it's been part of American food for such a long time. Like, American Chinese restaurants are everywhere, and there are sit-down restaurants, buffets, takeouts, carryouts. So many people eat it. I guess I'm not surprised that a restaurant owner would feel pressure to do something extra, but walking through the snow to get food to a customer? Like, that's a lot extra.
It is pretty extra. And you're right, Chinese food is super popular. But I can imagine the lengths to which Chinese Americans would go to run a competitive restaurant. As Emmalyn was saying, Chinese food's popularity grew out of a really dark history. Like, a little over 100 years ago, which may seem long, but is really only, like, 3 to 4 generations ago, white Americans literally thought Chinese cuisine was just rats.
So what changed?
Well, before delivery took off, American Chinese food had to ride this wave of being both exotic and trendy, but, like, also familiar.
Ah, an insider and outsider food.
Yes. To get a sense of the roller coaster ride that American Chinese food has been on, let's take a little field trip 139 years back to 1882.
I love field trips.
1882 is the year that American Chinese restaurants started to increase, because although they existed before, there's one major thing that happens this year that pushes Chinese people toward the restaurant industry. The U.S. passes the Chinese Exclusion Act, essentially barring Chinese immigration and naturalization, a.k.a.
a moment of very strong anti-Chinese sentiment.
That's Heather Ruth Lee, an assistant professor of history at NYU Shanghai, no connection to Jennifer 8 Lee. Heather researches immigration and food in the United States. Heather's work is all about trying to understand this dissonance, the difference in how white Americans feel about Chinese people versus how they feel about Chinese food.
How is it possible for Chinese restaurants to be expanding, the number of them to be growing, at a time in which it was really difficult to come into the country?
Yeah, that's so strange. How could these restaurants be blowing up so fast during that time?
Well, when Chinese people were banned from entering the country, the Chinese people who already lived in the United States were also actively discriminated against in the workplace. So they were pushed into jobs that Americans viewed as inferior women's work, laundries and restaurants.
So how did so many of these restaurants wind up being successful in, like, this racist country? Like, were these restaurants for Chinese diners?
At first, yes. A lot of early immigrants came from the same southeastern region of China called Toisan. So Chinese restaurants were largely for Chinese people. But then an age-old marketing tactic changed the game. A celebrity influencer created a food trend.
That was Ruth Tam and Patrick Fort of the podcast Dish City out of WAMU in Washington, D.C., explaining the crucial role of Chinese restaurants in creating restaurant delivery as we know it today. For years, we followed Adrian Miller, a.k.a. Soul Food Scholar, as he investigates barbecue across the country. We're thrilled that he won a James Beard Award for his latest book, Black Smoke. In it, he writes, quote, "Black-run barbecue joints often find themselves located at the intersection of food, race, and absurdity."
Barbecue was one of the places where people kind of ignored the color line in terms of restaurants. So you would often find whites going into the black neighborhood to get barbecue.
I don't think I'm alone when I say I've been waiting for Adrian's book for a long time. From the surprising and often overlooked beginnings of American barbecue, Adrian chronicles the evolution and the entrepreneurship of Black barbecue as he stokes the coals of its living legacy. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, good to be with you.
Let's start at the beginning with the word, which has its roots in West Africa. Can you explain how barbecue's history starts with the indigenous people of the Americas and then the primary cooking techniques that were used?
Yeah, and the reason I start with the indigenous people in the Americas, mainly mainland North America, is the Caribbean origin story never really quite gelled for me when it came to Southern barbecue. Because that story is that Europeans show up in the Caribbean, they see indigenous people cooking in a way they're not familiar with, and then Europeans bring that to the North American mainland. And, you know, the way that Southern barbecue emerges is just so different from the way that at least what the Europeans observed in the Caribbean was. So I argue that really it was a fusion of Native American kind of smoking techniques. And there were multiple ways that Native Americans were cooking. So in some senses, they were having sticks that were aimed towards the fire, and there would be morsels of meat kind of angled toward the fire for cooking. There was spit cooking, which Europeans would have been familiar with. There was also something called an earth oven. So it was really like a vertical hole with a fuel source in the bottom and then layers of meat and vegetation. And then you bury it and then come back at some time later and eat that. There was also kind of the raised platform, which is what people saw in the Caribbean. And then also a very shallow pit, which a lot of times the meat was just laid right on the burning coals. And so what I argue is that Europeans saw some of this and then added their own grilling techniques, and that put us on the road to barbecue. And then later, when enslaved Africans increase in number, they become barbecue's principal cooks and add their own kind of culinary signature to what would become barbecue.
So talk a little more about that transition.
What surprised me in researching this book is that Native Americans were the first barbecue cooks, really, and that they were enslaved as well. So the earliest forms of barbecue were probably cooked by enslaved Native Americans and white indentured servants before the transition to African slavery. So then when enslaved Africans are asked to cook this way, they start to meld their own kind of meat cooking and smoking traditions from West Africa with European grilling techniques and what Native Americans were doing. And it becomes this kind of unique thing. So a lot of people in the time of colonial America called barbecue cooking the Indian way. And what you find is there's some African-American barbecuers well into the 20th century who still described this kind of old school barbecue as cooking the Indian way. And that was digging a trench a few feet wide, a few feet deep, filling it with hardwood coals that were burned down, and then taking whole animal carcasses. So that could be a pig, sheep. If they did a cow, they would usually quarter it because cows are so big. butterflying them, sticking poles in the side of them, and then somebody flipped those carcasses regularly to cook them without burning and then added sauce throughout the process. And so that was what barbecue was originally, in terms of like Southern barbecue.
How did it figure into antebellum social life?
So in the early years, especially in Virginia, I agree with some scholars that Virginia is really the birthplace of Southern barbecue. Early on, it was really small gatherings, usually wealthy people getting together. And then the other side of barbecue was kind of rowdy parties where usually dudes got together, shotguns, gambled, played games, told lies, all that kind of stuff. And then over time, as barbecue becomes more popular, politicians and preachers get a hold of it and supersize it. So by the time we get to the 1820s and 30s, we're seeing reports of barbecues with 10, 20, 50,000 people. And I think barbecue was perfect for these events because it was so scalable. As long as you had enough labor, and usually that's why they turned to enslaved people because they could make them do this work. As long as you had enough labor, enough animals, and enough space, you could pull off a barbecue.
Barbecue, like church, you say, is about building community. So can you talk about the relevance one has to the other, and in particular, this phrase, theological barbecue?
Yeah, so in kind of the religious awakening period in the United States, you had these things called revivals or camp meetings. And so these would be multiple day affairs where they were preaching all day long and then they were eating at certain breaks. And barbecue fit well to that because, again, it was scalable and you could feed a lot of people. And so that was a way to draw a crowd and hopefully get converts to your religion. But on the plantations, enslaved African Americans also used barbecue to build church in a very small sense. And so usually enslaved people had the weekends off, especially the Sabbath. And with the work schedule slowed, that gave time to barbecue. There were also reports of secret barbecues where enslaved people would kind of, quote unquote, borrow a pig and cook it out of the sight of the slaveholder. And a lot of times those were religious gatherings as well. And so you get this connection to church and barbecue, both in the private kind of small gatherings on the plantation and also these grand, larger kind of big scale public events called camp meetings.
One of the most powerful parts of your book are just the numerous profiles of these legendary figures of Black barbecue that everyone should know. Could you just tell us some stories about some of these people?
Yeah, you know, that was one of the most fun parts of researching this book. So a couple people who come to mind. One is a woman named Marie Jean. That would have been her French name. She was also known as Mary John. But she was a woman in Arkansas Post, which was one of the earliest European settlements in what we now call Arkansas. And in the 1840s, there are newspaper reports of this enslaved African-American woman being what we would call a pitmaster. Back then, they called it superintending. And so they talked about her being in charge of these big barbecues. So, I mean, just think of that. Enslaved Black woman, in charge of barbecue, telling dudes what to do. Eventually, she buys her freedom and runs a restaurant in Arkansas Post. And when she dies in the 1850s, the local newspaper eulogized her and really celebrated her cooking. So I just think that's a remarkable story. And it shows you that at least in African-American circles, women were in the barbecue game going way back. Another guy that I loved to write about was a guy named Columbus B. Hill, who shows up in my home state of Colorado in the 1870s. And by the 1880s, he's on regularly doing barbecues for 5,000 to 10,000 people. So on July 4th, 1890, when the cornerstone for the Colorado State Capitol was laid, he did a barbecue for 25,000 people in front of the Capitol.
So fascinating. Could you share another profile with us?
Yeah. So another woman who was very interesting was a woman named Ernestine Vandeval. And she was from Nicodemus, Kansas. And if people don't know about Nicodemus, they should spend some time getting to know about it. It's one of the oldest all-Black communities in the U.S. And it was started by a group of people called Exodusters. And these were people who left the South for better opportunities right after slavery ended, so right after emancipation. And she grows up in this community and she moves to California and she ends up running a barbecue and soul food joint in Pasadena. which was beloved. Evidently, Walt Disney loved her food. And she ends up later in life returning to Nicodemus and opens a barbecue restaurant there, which still exists to this day. And her niece runs it now because Miss Vandeval died several years ago. So her niece, Angela Bates, runs this place. So every summer, usually last weekend in July or first weekend in August, Nicodemus has what it calls homecoming days. And so any living descendant or, you know, person who used to live in Nicodemus, they come back to this community and it's a big party and anybody is welcome. And Angela Bates opens up the restaurant and serves up some very tasty ribs.
Wow. How and when did barbecue move into, quote, mainstream America?
So I argue that it moved into mainstream America in the 20th century. And a lot of this was due to the transition from rural barbecue to urban barbecue. So rural barbecue was whole animal cooking over a trench filled with hardwood burning coals. But when you get to an urban environment, that's not always so practical. And so we get the construction of artificial pits. The early pits were usually brick or cinder block. And then we start to see, instead of whole animal cooking, people focusing on parts of animals. So that's when you start to see ribs, pork shoulder, sausages, chicken, all of that kind of grow in popularity. And then it leads to innovation in the various regional styles that we argue about today.
So this notion of, quote, legit, unquote, Black barbecue businesses, to, you know, that they're supposed to look run down, and then the relationship between the owners and operators to their white customers. Could you speak about that and the evolution of Black barbecue as a business?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So, you know, this idea that a barbecue place is supposed to look a certain way speaks to kind of the discrimination that Black entrepreneurs have faced, you know, from the very beginning of this country. And that main thing is the lack of access to capital. So when Black barbecuers wanted to start a business, especially a barbecue business, and that was one of the most popular businesses to start, they would usually just dig a hole in the ground and do the old trench method. So you had people running places out in the country, you know, there would be a designated spot, or they would do it from their lawn on their house. But when people started to look for brick and mortar locations, they just never got a nice spot on the main business thoroughfare. So it usually was in a rundown part of town, and usually the building itself was run down. And because of a lack of access to capital, these entrepreneurs really could not, you know, improve the physical plant of their restaurant. So that became kind of an aesthetic norm. And people loved what these entrepreneurs were cooking, but, you know, they would just say, oh, these are the signs of a good place. But that was really a reflection that a large number of these entrepreneurs never got enough money to really shore up all those other aspects of their business and beautify it.
You have a tongue-in-cheek recipe for disappearing Black barbecue. When did the shift in media's coverage of the brilliance of Black barbecue to its exclusion occur?
I peg it to the 1990s. And I think the big thing that changed was the rise of this group that we call foodies. So we've always had people who kind of looked at food as leisure and sport, but they tended to be very wealthy. But what happens with foodies in the late 1980s and then the early 1990s is you've got a group of middle-class people who've got disposable income. Their palate is much more adventurous than their parents, and they're looking for authentic experiences. And just as this group rises, you have a commensurate rise in food media to cater this group. And so barbecue was growing in popularity around the same time. So foodies wanted to know, hey, what is barbecue and where can I get the good stuff? And unfortunately, because the people who decide what stories get told were not diverse, more and more white people were put forth as experts. Because the people who were looking for stories would just ask other white people, yeah, who should we profile? Who should we, you know, talk about?
Who is out there that you want us to know about?
One guy is Matt Horn. He's in Oakland, and he's on the way to opening up the brick and mortar spot. It's kind of hard to do that these days. There's another guy, and I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, but I remember the restaurant is called Veg Mob because vegan barbecue is pretty hot trend right now. And so I want folks to know about them. Also, if you haven't seen Queer Eye, the Jones sisters in Kansas City, Kansas, great people doing great food. Their sauce business has taken off after being on that show. And then the coolest thing about them, oh, one of the cool things, but I just love this. They have a barbecue vending machine. So 24/7, you can just show up and get sandwiches or whatever. I just think that's brilliant.
Well, Adrian, what a pleasure. And I just look forward to so many sessions with this book, reading all the stories.
Well, thank you so much.
Colorado author Adrian Miller is a certified Kansas City Barbecue Society judge and has won 2 James Beard Awards for his food scholarship. We've been discussing barbecue and his latest award-winning book, Black Smoke, African Americans and the United States of Barbecue. In a minute, we take a sweet trip down Chinese Bakery Lane. That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. The sight of egg tarts being rolled on a cart through the dining room signifies the end of another glorious dim sum feast. While the sunny pastries may be the most recognizable Chinese sweet here in the United States, the array of offerings at a Chinese bakery will make your head spin. Christina Chow began her career as an architect, but then she channeled her love of baking into a blog, Eat Cho Food. Eventually, that spawned an award-winning cookbook, Mooncakes and Milk Bread, sweet and savory recipes inspired by Chinese bakeries. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Evan.
When and where did Chinese bakeries first gain popularity?
Chinese bakeries first started to get really popular in Hong Kong, which is where my family is from. There's a lot of kind of different cultural influences in Hong Kong. A big one is from like British culture, lots of breads, teas, custards, and tarts and things like that. And over the years, they've kind of melded with the Chinese palate, different ingredients that we really love, like mangoes and tea, to create this really unique kind of like subset of baking that we know now as Chinese baking.
And how do the baked goods kind of find an expression within the cafe culture?
I would say that a lot of the baked goods in cafe culture, they're the airiest, they're the fluffiest, they're kind of like the most delicate version that they are. And a lot of times they are fairly similar to like the Western versions that we might often see. Milk bread as a common base for a lot of these bakeries is very similar to say like a challah or a brioche being enriched bread. But in a Chinese bakery sense, a lot of times, again, the texture and everything like that is lighter, airier, and the sweetness level is also kind of a little bit more delicate and balanced. A lot of times you don't want something to be too cloyingly sweet.
So your background is in architecture. How did you become obsessed with baking and this particular kind of baking?
I've always just in general been obsessed with food. I grew up in a restaurant family. My grandparents owned Chinese restaurants, and so I would spend my afternoons after school there. And I was surrounded by amazing cooks, but we did not have a lot of bakers. But my own passion of baking kind of just developed out of that void of not having any like home bakers really around me too often. So when I was in middle school, I was like very obsessed with watching like Food Network and like collecting library books or just taking them out of the library and teaching myself how to make from scratch things like cookies and brownies and cakes and pastries. So I'm very much a self-taught baker. But at the same time, I think because I have kind of like an architectural mind, I think it really lends itself to kind of the way that bakers and pastry people approach their recipes.
So let's focus for a minute on milk bread, that it's so impossibly fluffy. It's super addicting, like the platonic ideal of a Wonder Bread.
Yeah, exactly.
How does it differ from other enriched breads, like you mentioned before, like challah or brioche?
What sets milk bread apart from other enriched breads is the addition of a tongzong, which is a mixture of milk and flour. And what you do is you kind of cook it low and slow in a saucepan until you create like a thick paste or slurry. And what it is now is a highly concentrated kind of like pack of hydration that you can incorporate into your bread dough without weighing down your dough, so it won't get super sticky. And then everything else, again, it's very similar to other enriched doughs. There's like egg, butter, milk, some type of fat to keep it like soft. But it's just the ratios are a little different.
What are some classic forms that milk bread take, and what are they used for?
Milk bread is so versatile, and I think that's what makes it an incredibly fun dough to master and continue to work with. So, of course, you can form it into just a loaf of bread, but even in a loaf of bread, there's all these different shapes it can take on. You can form it into like the very classic three-segment loaf, which a lot of milk breads are formed that way. You can put it in a Pullman loaf pan, which all it is, just it has a lid on it, so you can get that really satisfying like square profile of a loaf of bread. And then when you want to start creating different buns, there are so many designs. I think I have like 8 designs or so in my book, but it can really go beyond that. You can kind of twist it and fill it with different fillings like Nutella or red bean paste and form it into a spiral. You can not twist it at all and just kind of make like a open face. They kind of look like little pizzas where you squish the dough down and put a topping on it. And that's a really popular one because it's so easy. But yeah, you can really go with your imagination. And as long as the bread is nice and hydrated and pliable, there's so many shapes it can take on.
How is bread treated differently across China?
It varies so much. So the milk bread is like a very soft bread, and I think more of a modern interpretation of bread in Hong Kong. And when you go to different regions, you'll see bread that's like cooked more like a flat bread in a type of tandoor oven. So there's different breads called like xiaobing, which can go sweet or savory. It's like a spiraled bread that is oftentimes encrusted with sesame seeds, so it gets like really nice and toasty and has a wonderful crunch to it. I have a sweet version in my book. Another bread that I can think of is called mo. And I first had that bread when I was in Xi'an, China. And it's like akin to like an English muffin. And this, again, is kind of cooked in like a kind of brick or like earthenware oven. And the outsides get really nice and toasty, and the center stays really soft. And it's the perfect bread to like stuff with stewed lamb or stewed pork, sop up all those juices. So there's so many variations.
How do styles of mooncakes vary from region to region around China? I would love to hear about both classic fillings and some alternatives.
So I grew up enjoying the Cantonese style mooncakes because that's my family is Cantonese. And the Cantonese style mooncake is a small, well, relatively small pastry where the exterior crust is like soft and chewy. The best thing I can compare it to is kind of the texture of like a fig Newton. And then the inside is typically filled with sweet pastes like white lotus paste, red bean paste, black sesame paste. Sometimes you'll find a salted egg yolk in there for like a sweet and salty type of flavor. And occasionally you'll find like mixed nuts. But this year I made for the first time Shanghai style mooncakes, which the exterior, instead of being soft and chewy, it's more of a flaky pastry. And then the inside is filled with this like really delicious seasoned pork filling. I use the recipe from my Shanghai and it's like really, really wonderful. There's so many different styles. I have another style called the thousand layer mooncake, where again, it's kind of like a flaky pastry, but the way that you laminate it and roll it out gives the mooncake an appearance that it has 1,000 layers to it. And it's also filled with like a sweet paste. And you can find those in Taiwan a lot of times. But I think what connects all of them is that they're meant to be shared. That's the tradition during Mid-Autumn Festival, which is when you would typically eat mooncakes, is that they're small bites of food that you cut into wedges and share with your friends and family under a full moon.
Thank you so much. This was just such a lovely conversation.
That's architect turned food blogger Christina Cho. Her cookbook, Mooncakes and Milk Bread, offers an insider's look at Chinese bakeries, along with recipes that will entice you to start a brand new baking journey. Up next, a must-see documentary about Native Americans who are reconnecting the way they eat with their spiritual practices. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Healing is at the center of the documentary Gather. It's a must-see for anyone who lives and eats in the United States of America. Director Sanjay Rawal opens the film with a quote from Crazy Horse of the Oglala Lakota Nation. "The Red Nation shall rise again, and it shall be a blessing for a sick world, a world filled with broken promises, selfishness, and separations, a world longing for light again." Sanjay joins us to discuss the growing movement of Native Americans working to reconnect with their spiritual and cultural identity. Hi, Sanjay.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm good. It was such an interesting and really effective film that you made. What were the circumstances under which Crazy Horse made these remarks?
It was in the late 1860s, I believe, when his people were being attacked relentlessly by the U.S. military. And it wasn't the same sort of incursions that had been occurring for 150 years. Post-Civil War, with the U.S. military depleted, they launched what are now termed asymmetrical tactics. They began slaughtering buffalo indiscriminately and burning fields, destroying the Native American food system by force in order to yoke them to American army rations. And so it was at the end of this period of incredible destruction that Crazy Horse made that statement.
It's just such a horror story that continues. What drew you to tell the stories of modern Native Americans and their quest to salvage their threatened culture and this painful history?
Well, my first documentary film was called Food Chains, and it was about a group of migrant farm workers in Florida called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Now, they managed to get some of the largest agribusiness giants in the world to negotiate to support their rights and their fair pay. Now, these workers are broadly seen as Latino, but they're primarily from Chiapas, Oaxaca, and Guatemala, and speak Spanish as a second or even third language. So that was kind of my first entry into working and seeing the ideals of indigenous agriculturalists. And I'd always wanted to explore that further, past the labor aspect, and look at the initial theft of land that drove the American economy. And that theft of land really was directly related to the destruction of the Native American food system.
There's an Apache farmer who speaks of food sovereignty, saying it's, quote, "an apprenticeship to food and recovery. We're not transforming food. Food is transforming us," unquote. There are several themes that run throughout the film, including capitalism and recovery. Native Americans were eventually seen as an impediment to the growth of the American economy. Can you talk about the restorative revolution that's taking place within Native American culture?
Certainly. And just for a bit of context, you know, it wasn't until the European Crusades, and then on a larger scale, the European push to colonize the Western Hemisphere, that there was this idea of large-scale extractive capitalism. Land had always had value, but it didn't have the value in multiples that the colonists saw in the New World. And in order to really reap the benefits of those multiples, they needed land, and they needed Native American land. The what's now the U.S. was by no means wilderness. It was a carefully cultivated ecosystem, you know, with native scientists, with native animal husbandry experts, native hunters, native farmers that have been working in harmony with Mother Earth for tens of thousands of years. when capitalism first realized the value of a calorie and the value of exporting that calorie away from its origin to lands far away or cities far away, the entire view of food within culture was changed. It became a commodity and not something that had a spiritual or cultural value. Now, Indian countries' land was taken away, but their culture was destroyed too, systemically, trying to separate them from their traditions in order to assimilate them, in order to get access to their resources. So now, in the 21st century, most of Indian country has been separated by force from the same types of food traditions that gave them the strength they had pre-contact. At the same time, they're at the end of supply chains, they don't have economic opportunity, and it's much easier to buy junk food than it is to buy healthy food. So to save themselves physically and to restore their cultural and spiritual pride, they've kind of turned to rediscovering those old food ways and making them the norm. So to answer your question, they feel like the Industrial Revolution is over, the extractive capitalism that drove economies has to end, and people have to develop a relationship with Earth that's more unconditional and that's less extractive. And that needs to start with the food system first and foremost.
I was especially drawn to Master Forager Twyla Cazador of the San Carlos Apache Nation. She says, reconnecting people to who they are, it's like planting that little seed. It's never Taco Tuesday. Her approach is simultaneously, I mean, obviously so deep and deeply filled with knowledge, but gentle. And how she uses this act of gathering to teach so many lessons. Can you speak about her in particular?
Yeah, Twyla Cazador was an amazing person to spend time around. Frankly, I hadn't encountered somebody that was that felt that close to the rhythms of Mother Earth than her. I mean, we'd drive down a highway and she'd recognize an area that she harvested wild onions from years before, and looked at the calendar, realized it might be onion season, tromped through what I thought was just a wilderness of thickets, found a particular area that she remembered and recalled, started digging with her fingers, and all of a sudden began pulling out the most refreshing, most floral little wild onions that I'd ever tasted. And that made it apparent to me the importance of knowing your land. So many of us rely on supermarket diets, or even if we go to farmers markets, you know, we're not in touch with the actual process of raising or growing that food. And there's something that's deeply healing about knowing exactly where you are and knowing exactly what your relationship is with your environment, knowing how much that environment sustains you. And I think at the end of the day, Twyla is a walking example of someone who's constantly grateful to Mother Earth in a way that I think we all need to aspire to be.
Also, in the scenes where she is harvesting with her granddaughter, the way she uses the act of gathering to teach language, I thought was also really interesting. Rather than being in a static kind of school setting, which might put off some young people, it was a living, breathing lesson that encompassed sort of everything, every part of the culture.
Yeah, one of the kind of horrific aspects of the ongoing colonization that only became really illegal in 1977 was the establishment of Indian boarding schools, where Native kids were forcibly taken from their parents in many cases, put into boarding schools where they were punished for speaking their own language. Now, when you lose your language, you lose the names of foods, you lose the names of plants, so that you don't actually have a frame of reference in the environment that you might live. So people like Twyla's granddaughter, May, their parents had gone to boarding school, their parents had lost the language and therefore hadn't been able to teach all the plant names, animal names in Apache to their young daughter. And so Twyla takes them out into the wild and lets them know that all of these plants, all of these critters, insects, animals, they're part of the Apache family. There are words that describe not only the species, but the relationships that Apache had always had with these forms of life. And so when she takes young May out to forage and to hunt, you know, May is introduced not just to the environment, but to her identity, what it actually means to be an Apache woman.
Did you see that going on with many children of May's generation, or is it unusual for a young person to have the interest?
It's very unusual, and I would say it's rare to have a mentor like Twyla. You know, as soon as you take a kid out into that environment, the interest is apparent. It's exciting. It's adventurous, but you know, as everyone knows, Indian country is part of some of the most economically disadvantaged community land in the U.S., pretty much by design. And kids don't really have the structure to have those types of mentors and those types of elders. Parents, relatives are constantly working just to make ends meet. And kids there, just like kids everywhere, end up just watching TV and playing video games. They gravitate to what's easy. And Twyla's a rare example of someone who's been able to cultivate a lot of interest amongst parents to send their kids off on these foraging trips with her and gradually rebuild their sense of self and their sense of culture.
Thank you so much, Sanjay. What a wonderful film.
It's very, very kind of you. And thanks so much for this lovely conversation.
That's filmmaker Sanjay Rowell. His film Gather is a moving portrait of the Native movement for food sovereignty. You can watch it on Netflix.
If you missed any of today's show, you can always listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. And of course, you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or any podcast app you use. My thanks to the Good Food team. Elena Shatkin, Laurel Garcia, Tyler Boudreau, Ben Mims, Kenny Ng, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and PJ Shahamat. And special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. I currently have two books on my metaphorical nightstand. Dune, yeah, I know I'm late to the party, but the spice must flow. And A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.